Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. I have to remind you that we are now Zooming on Tuesday morning, and you know that something will be happening Tuesday night and Wednesday, but we will not get it to the end of the week. Before we begin our show, we, of course, embrace Skip Tenzer. He is our deadline poet. And as I always say, as Calvin Trillin is to the nation, Skip is to the attitude. Okay, Dave, hit it with the music.
Istanbul was Constantinople. Now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night.
So Twitter cut off Donald's big tweeter. This guy who's always turns up the heater. It's his main addiction to spread all his fiction. The withdrawals might give him a seizure.
People just liked it better that way.
So take me back to Constantinople. No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, why did Constantinople get the worst?
So I saw an article, everyone, at theconversation.com. And you know, I love this site because it brings experts from around the world, PhDs and professors, and encourages them to write a sort of regularly magazine-y type article so that we can then appreciate their knowledge and then put it into the context of what is happening right now in our politics and in our policy in America. And the title of the piece was entitled, Fired for Storming the Capitol? Why Most Workers Aren't Protected for What They Do on Their Own Time. And I went, wow, this is such a good story about the employer-employee relationship. But I didn't want to go to the person who wrote the story. I wanted to go to someone who I know, in part because she is an employer-employee expert when it comes to these labor issues, because I've known her for years, and because when it comes to the field of understanding the difference between the public and the private employer-employee relationship, Nancy Richard Stower is a person who can both articulate the issues at hand, the potential protections, the idea that it may differ from state to state. But January 6th has really showed us that we need to become familiar with these issues. One, because we may have friends who have participated. We may have enemies who have participated. And we are now hearing that there is not only a roundup of the individuals, but that people around the country are being fired by their employers because of their participation in the events that led up to, frankly, I think a lynch mob showing up at the Capitol on January 6th. So let me give you a little bit of Nancy Richard Stower's background before we begin. She is an employee advocate and the creator of TryToSettle.com, an online settlement service, was inducted into the College of Labor and Employment Lawyers in 2003, is a former member and chair of the New Hampshire Commission for Human Rights. In 2015, she was awarded the Granite State Advocate Award by the New Hampshire Association of Justice. She has operated a plaintiff's employment law practice in Merrimack, New Hampshire since 1989. The list of her credentials could go on for 20 minutes. The fact that she's been recognized by so many groups around the country would also take another 15 or 20 minutes. But when it comes to this issue, she is someone who is clear. She is someone who has great understanding. And she is someone I think that can inform our audience in a way that I think is terribly important in light of the fact that this is not a one-off, what is happening on January 6th, but this is perhaps the beginning of a pattern in practice, and we all need to be informed. So with that, let me welcome my good friend, Nancy Richard Stower, to the program. Thank you so much for doing this, Nancy.
Nice to be here, Arnie.
We are seeing the FBI, we're seeing cops beginning to round up people because of all the violence that happened on January 6th. What I think is surprising to a lot of people is that they're also seeing something else. They're hearing that a number of people have been recognized because they've live streamed their participation or because they happen to be in some kind of a selfie shot, that employers are now calling up some of the people that participated. And they said to them, you know, you used to work for X, Y, and Z company. You've now been fired. And people are saying, wait a minute, what happened to my First Amendment rights? I'm able to participate. This had nothing to do with my employer-employee relationship. It had to do with my right of free speech. So with that as the landscape, Nancy, can you explain to my audience about what an employer can do, especially in a private employment situation that I think most people will be shocked by? They thought that they had some level of control during their work hours, 9 to 5, 7 to 4, whatever it is. But now we're beginning to find out how far that reach can go when it comes to that contractual relationship.
Well, I think it's important, first of all, to make it clear that there are two groups of employees with vastly different employment rights. And that would be government employees on any level of government, federal through state, through local, municipal. And on the other place, private employees. Let's just do the easy one first, private employees. Their rights are always a function of state law. State law. There are federal laws that might give whistleblowers protection, et cetera. But the bottom line is for this kind of activity that we're seeing, it would be state law. And generally speaking, across the country, if you're not in a union, you are an employee at will, able to be fired for no reason or any reason, good reason or bad reason, with or without notice, so long as it's not an illegal reason. And what is an illegal reason is a function of state law. So many states have protections, like if you're asking for your wages to be paid and you're fired, that is a speech that is protected, and retaliation, discrimination. I saw somebody being sexually harassed, you're fired, that's speech, but it is protected speech, even though you are a private employee. My knowledge base is New Hampshire mostly, and here you're an employee at will, but there are public policy exceptions. And New Hampshire led the way, Arnie. For everybody who is a private employee, not in a union, was an employee at will, able to be fired for no reason or any reason. And New Hampshire was one of the first states to make an exception to that. And it is an exception that if what you are doing is in furtherance of public policy, then you can't be fired for it. And the first case was what we would consider today a sexual harassment case, where it was sort of like, you want a promotion, sleep with me, babe. And the woman was fired, and her lawyer brought a lawsuit and said, hey, in New Hampshire, anyway, if you're married, you can't stray outside the marriage. It's actually a crime in New Hampshire, and you can't make my client commit a crime to keep her job. And that case was called Monge versus Beebe Rubber. And it's kind of famous nationally because it stood for, you can't make somebody do something bad. And bad is public policy. And guess what? Well, in New Hampshire, what is public policy is a function of what the jury says it is. Mm-hmm. So you can't be fired for doing something that public policy wants you to do. And you can't be fired for refusing to do something that public policy doesn't want you to do. Apart from union settings, union employees get much more protection. If you're a government employee, your baseline is the federal law and the First Amendment. And that used to be something that protected government employees in what was called, and the constitutional experts you'll talk to nationwide will be able to be much more articulate. But the bottom line is the employer had to balance, the government agency had to balance your speech versus how disruptive it was in the workplace. And there were many cases, and one is called Pickering, one is called Connors. We used to always use that as a base because state constitutions can give you more rights and state government employee freedom of expression statutes can give you more rights like we have in New Hampshire. But what happened is that in 2006, the case called Garcetti versus Sabalos came down. And what had happened was there was a district attorney who figured out that the sheriffs had gotten a warrant based on certain information and then enforced it differently. And it was like whether the road to the left, they could go to the house, or the road to the right. It was something that I didn't really understand the factual background because I'm not an investigator. But what happened is this district attorney figured it out and he let the defendant's counsel know, hey, this warrant, bad. Mm-hmm. And then he had a meeting with the sheriff's department and other cases and all the crap hit the fan. He was sentenced to something called highway punishment where they, in LA, assigned him a district like 30 miles away and it took him like 9 hours a day to commute or something. But what the Supreme Court said in a 5-4 decision was that because his speech was about his job responsibilities, that could not be protected by the First Amendment or every employment case of a federal employee or a government employee would be subject to litigation. Boy, this blew all of us away because imagine you're a nuclear scientist. You figure out that your plant is leaking crap into the ocean and you talk about it and you get fired. You report it, you get fired, apart from whistleblower statutes, which may be specific. You're not protected anymore after Garcetti versus Sabalos.
Oh my God.
Civil rights Because, and who knows more about the bad stuff that's going on than people who have it as their job duties? So in New Hampshire, for example, we said, hey, we want to fix that. And some civil liberties folks, we got together and we drafted a statute to undo it.
Okay.
And in New Hampshire, there is something called the Public Employees Freedom of Expression statute. And it says that you can't get fired for speaking about stuff. Unfortunately, the New Hampshire Supreme Court in the last couple of years has gutted it.
Okay.
And they interpreted our state statute in a way that excluded anything that wasn't said publicly. So if you can't prove that somebody could have overheard you, you're not protected. Other states have melded, and we also have a whistleblower statute, and all 50 states have state whistleblower statutes or have the federal whistleblower statutes that pertain to that particular area may help them. Arnie, if somebody calls you and says, geez, what do? I was at that demonstration and I'm all over the internet.
Right.
You tell them to call a criminal defense attorney first. Employment law is not their concern right now. Their criminal liability is, because a lot of them are going to be charged with conspiracy to, and then whatever the federal crimes are that they're going to be nailed with. And it could include manslaughter or murder. So they need a criminal law attorney. The criminal law attorney can work in the different states with their employment law experts. But private employees generally can be fired for anything. So they're out of it. But public employees, like in New Hampshire, we've got this Troy chief of police or whatever, sheriff or whatever.
And let me just give a little history here. So I know in New Hampshire, he was in New York Magazine. That's how they found him. He was being interviewed by New York Magazine. He's the police chief in Troy. And he claims that he was leaving the event, that he did not do the assault on the Capitol, that he had gone to the rally, that he suddenly realized that the rally was sort of getting out of control. And so what he did was he decided to basically go home. All right. He actually brought Trump paraphernalia into his police chief office, and he was told that he had to remove it. So obviously there's a little question as to where he understands the limits of his political participation. So he's been on record for sort of potentially abusing his authority as the police chief. And then he shows up there. So we also know that there are a group of, I think, maybe state troopers from Seattle who are also seen being there. I don't know whether they did the assault on the Capitol, but they were seen being there. So now my question is, what is policy for the purposes of these state employees or local police chiefs? What is the difference between just participation in something that is being created to overturn an election versus participation in something that does the actual assault on the Capitol? Are we able to be able to, one, distinguish between the two? I'm sure we are. And number two, do those public employees have protection, even though they seem to sort of exhibit something that showed maybe weak or poor judgment?
Yeah, it's evidence of crime. There has to be evidence.
Okay.
Criminal activity in order to take away the First Amendment right to protest, think, because allegedly the concern was whether or not the election was carried out in an honest way, who won the election, allegedly was their basis for protesting. Shouting, yelling, those things are generally not illegal. But as soon as those folks were on the Capitol grounds crawling up the steps like maggots, everything changed. And they are all who are identifiable going to be responsible, including for the death of the police officer who was murdered on the steps of the Capitol building. I'm a longtime demonstrator. I was in DC in 69, 70. There were a million of us on the mall. I remember DC police coming in, and I remember all of that. And I remember some of us were arrested and some of us weren't. And the point is that at some point, Arnie, public safety has to take priority. I read something recently and I had remembered it myself. During May Day, there were sweep arrests in Washington, D.C. The dean of the George Washington University Law School, my college, was swept away. Priests coming out of their church. Everybody on the street was arrested, brought to a field outside of RFK Stadium for 3 days. Most of them, all the charges were dismissed. It was unconstitutional. But the authorities felt, we don't really care about the Constitution. We don't care about the law. We care about, and back then it was just Nixon wanting to get government employees to be able to drive their cars over the bridges to go to work. Mm-hmm. So the fact that these people were caught up in something that got out of hand is not just their fault. It's the fault of the government for not putting public safety first. And we'll find out about the
inside. Can they argue that? Can they argue that?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, that's one of the things I kept thinking about is that when you look at the sort of potpourri of individuals, there are definitely people, you know, that wanted to put the noose up, that came with battering rams. Their intent was
it's evidence, Arnie. It's evidence. What did they say? What is the evidence against them? Were they on the grounds of the Capitol? Were they on the steps? If they were inside the Capitol building, it's no brainer. They're guilty of some crime. But it's going to be evidence. But it's not going to be what they were screaming. They can't get, there are First Amendment protections for what they were screaming. Now, when it comes to the cop, though, when you do the First Amendment balancing test, not New Hampshire special law, but the constitutional federal, you have to balance their right to freedom of expression and how disruptive that speech is going to create in the workplace. And I could very easily argue on behalf of the town of Troy that you can't have your chief law enforcement officer being connected with that it would interfere with the validity of anything else the department does or says.
I'm going to just say something to you, and this is the absolute truth. I know a couple of friends who are concerned about the events that are going to be happening at 50 state capitals around the country, okay? A couple of them are very out there and outspoken. They're either, you know, state senators or legislators or whatever. They're worried about their own personal safety.
And they should be.
No. But they're afraid to call the cops because they're not sure that in New Hampshire, if they lived in Troy, should they call the Troy police chief to say, I'm worried about my safety, knowing the sentiments of the Troy police chief who goes to an event in Washington where it is to overturn an election, where they're told to be wild, where you know that violence is encouraged. We have a congresswoman from, I believe it is Colorado, who walks around with her gun 2 days before January 6th and encourages people to show up with their guns. And here's the problem. You don't know whether what attracted the cop or the teacher or the police chief to attend the event was just the generic protest, save our country, save America, you know, save the election. Or were they encouraged because they were on, you know, Parler, Newsmax, 4chan, and they were looking at things that obviously told them that we are prepared to do violence.
What I say,
and that's what scares me, is what was the invitation?
These people who think that they are out there expressing their First Amendment rights, marching up Pennsylvania Avenue, Constitution Avenue, they were pawns. And just like a lot of demonstrators and a lot of demonstrations are pawns of the people who wish and have the power to manipulate the pawns, which is so easy with the internet. Getting back to that police chief, I think that doing the balancing test, is it disruptive enough so that it will interfere in his being able to do his duties? And I think the answer is clearly yes. Now, ironically, if he hadn't been seen on the camera or the video or done that interview, not a bright guy, obviously. And the only knowledge that was kind of like buzz around town that he was in DC, I think he'd be fine. But once he's been publicly identified, I know that your broadcast is not appropriate to New Hampshire. Remember recently there was a cop that was fired because he had tweeted or texted his wife a sentiment that was racist on a phone, and the police force found out and they said, we can't have this guy on the force because next time there's a racial incident, you know, here's the evidence against us. This is evidence of his intent and his motivation. And right now it's kind of in flux because it was an arbitration and a union involved. His job may be safe after all. But the point is that in employment law, which is different than First Amendment law, if we're talking private employment law as it pertains to government officials. In other words, not federal law, state law.
Right.
Intent is proved by the statements that the actor has made in other places.
If he goes to his Facebook page, and he says, oh, I'm going to, you know, because he's a cop, he's allowed to carry weapons. But because we have open carry or whatever, he's going to say, I'm coming weaponized, even though he doesn't go to the Capitol, even though he decides this is too crazy, I'm going home. Intent to show up, not just in his capacity for exercising free speech and participating as a Trump supporter, but that he kind of knows that he has the potential to do something more, because you're looking at the whole package of what he said publicly, then that could be used against him.
Well, police officers and law enforcement are supposed to dispense their duties without reference to race, for example. So if you've got somebody who has expressed racist sentiments in my line of work, because I represent employees who've been discriminated against, that is evidence. The fact that he didn't say it to my client, about my client, it was a statement made to somebody else or about somebody else, is still evidence of his motivation. So these people, it depends what they said. And Arnie, I'm sure you, like me, have said stuff online that we wish that we hadn't in the moment of, you know, write and click. But the point is that for the people who think their jobs are safe under the United States Constitution's guarantees of freedom of speech, who work for private employees, they are very mistaken. And it's simple to us because you went to law school, I went to law school. The First Amendment only constrains the government. It doesn't constrain anything else. So you have to be a government actor or so closely aligned with the government under a government contract or something. It doesn't constrain private behavior.
So I'm so glad you said that, because I saw a tweet and a comment and I posted it on my Facebook page. I believe I even sent it to you. And while this isn't technically in the employer employment area, it is about freedom of speech, where the protections are and where they are not. And I'm going to read this to you, and I think I sent it to you. Now, this is a congressman, Matt Gaetz, G-A-E-T-Z. I believe he's from Colorado. He writes, "We cannot live in a world where Twitter's terms of service are more important than the terms in our Constitution and Bill of Rights." Someone responded, and she wrote, "We cannot live in a world where elected leaders don't know the difference between the Constitution and the terms and conditions of service." That says exactly what you just said. Twitter is a private company. Twitter can decide who participates, who doesn't. You may be ticked off at it. You may be angry at it, but they can make those conditions because they are not the government. They are a private company. Here is a congressman who is conflating the two and assuming that he has some sort of freedom of speech rights vis-a-vis Twitter, and someone is reminding him, you know what? Twitter ain't the Constitution.
Twitter doesn't have this kind of obligation. I don't think any of those congressmen who say those stupid things actually intellectually believe what they're saying. And that's scarier. The willingness to know what the truth is, to know what the law is, and then lie about it is why Trump had those gangs there. It's why Cruz has his career about to be handed to him. It's the willingness, and the reason is it works. People are so willing to believe the worst about other people. Trump actually had a significant percentage of the country believing that President Obama wasn't born in the United States because he said it over those megaphones.
There's a level of collective ignorance. We may know a headline, but we don't know the text. He's able to suggest that Barack Hussein Obama, and because you hear a name that is foreign to you, therefore he must not be American because his name isn't Bob Smith. Okay, I mean, understand that there is a seed that he can then fertilize and plant and then build his lie around.
There is no punishment for lying, and there's no good way to prove the truth except so far in some of our courts.
Right.
And that is why it was so important for the courts to throw out all the crap that the campaign brought to them. But the point is, the courts are political animals too. In many states, the Supreme Court judges are elected. Right. In the United States, the Supreme Court justices and their appointments and nominations has become the most political undertaking of any other aspect of government.
I'm going to close our conversation by going back to theconversation.com. You did not write this piece, but it really does sort of consolidate this last half hour. And again, it says, non-unionized workers in the United States, of which 90% of all workers are employed at will. That means you can be terminated at any time without notice for any reason. It doesn't even have to be a good reason. You just pointed that out. Unless the company has guaranteed your job in writing, or there is a specific law, a la New Hampshire, that may protect your conduct, such as laws protecting union organizing or whistleblowing, your fate is up to them. The law, however, is more protective when it comes to unionized workers and government employees. There, those workers may have a right to be terminated only for cause, and they might get a hearing process prior to being disciplined. Government workers are also protected by the First Amendment, particularly when it comes to free speech in their capacity as citizens rather than speech related to the workplace. What happened, however, on June 6th, the protest speech, the assault on the Capitol, the lynch mob, that ain't protected speech. That is an assault on the Capitol. Am I right?
You're right. January 6th was a day that will be bigger in the history of the United States than we can imagine.
And on that note, let me thank you for being my friend. Thank you for being so articulate. And I want to remind everyone, Nancy Richards-Sauer is an employee advocate. She is the creator owner of TryToSettle.com, an online settlement service. She was inducted into the college, indicted. See, this is what's happening. I've got it on my mind. Inducted into the College of Labor and Employment Lawyers in 2003. And as a former member and chair, this is the most important part of your resume, the New Hampshire Commission for Human Rights. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm going to call you again, I promise.
Thank you for having me, Arnie.
All right, everyone. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will be right back.
Here are some constitutional provisions that could well apply to the recent storming of the Capitol. I'm Bill Newman. On January 6th, insurrectionists carrying out the wishes of President Donald Trump stormed the Capitol to prevent the Congress from confirming the Electoral College vote for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. The mob overpowered the Capitol Police, smashed windows, ransacked offices, carried the Confederate flag, and desecrated that historic building, brought nooses, handcuffs, and explosives inside, and built a scaffold with a noose outside. Some were screaming, "Hang Pence!" 6 people died, including 2 police officers. The Constitution contains 2 remedies for aiding and abetting an insurrection. The 14th Amendment, in relevant part, says, "No person shall hold any office under the United States who, having previously taken an oath as an officer of the United States to support the Constitution, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof." The Constitution also provides for impeachment of the president for treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors, with only 2 potential punishments after conviction by the Senate: removal from office and disqualification to hold any future office. But that's not the end of the story, because the Constitution also says that, quote, "The party convicted by the Senate and punished shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to law." The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU, because freedom can't protect itself.
Twice.
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Again, a reminder, we are Zooming this Tuesday morning. I was sent a piece from Colorado, not a place I always follow. It was entitled, When COVID Hit, a Colorado County Kicked Out Second Homeowners. They hit back. How a group of non-resident homeowners tried to influence a rural Colorado election. Nick Bolin was the correspondent who wrote this lengthy, fabulous, almost novelette. It is one of the most powerful, compelling reads. He's a brilliant writer. As I was reading it, I realized he was telling us a story that was a microcosm of America as he was writing it, and that we really need to not only hear what happened to this community, but to understand it because it's happening to all of us virtually at the same time. A little bit about Nick Bolin. He was born and grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He graduated from my alma mater, St. Olaf College, which is why I'm ecstatic to have him on, but I did not know that when I reached out to him. And he describes it as a small school in southeastern Minnesota. Hell, we're the flagship of Lutheran colleges, Nick. He got his journalism start at a newspaper in the Philadelphia area covering local government. He then moved to Washington, where he covered campaigns, lobbying, and money in politics for E&E News, an environmental and energy publication. When not writing, he is usually exploring the mountains around Gunnison. And of course, that's really where the story starts. Nick, as I read your piece, the thing that kept looping into my head as I read the reaction of the county officials, the anger of the wealthy second homeowners, the fear that everybody was sort of embraced by because of this raging COVID, and this county had one of the highest rates of COVID contagion in the country, especially at the beginning, nobody, not even the specialists, understood how to react. You know, remember in the beginning they told us not to wear masks? Why? Well, the truth wasn't that masks weren't going to protect us, it's that we didn't have enough masks, and they wanted to make sure that the doctors and nurses had the masks. So they sort of lied to us in order to protect the frontline workers. And then we find out that they lied to us and that we all should have been wearing masks. And then we didn't recognize the level of contagion. There was just so much misinformation and lack of knowledge. Now, if that's true of the specialists, Nick, it was really true of elected officials who had to establish the rules of behavior to protect their county, to protect the public officials, to protect frontline workers, and to protect the residents. As we know, as in Colorado, as well as in my state of New Hampshire, there are a lot of wealthy second homeowners. And they're not even second homeowners. They all probably own four or five properties around the United States. And while they pay a lot of money, maybe in property taxes, and they buy the shishi houses, they don't really live there. They kind of come and go at their leisure. And yeah, they may contribute to the community in the way of property taxes, but they don't vote. They haven't been raised there. So they see this as sort of a nice little jewel in their portfolio, but they don't actually have to worry about the schools and about the health and safety and about the hospitals, because they can always go to the Mayo Clinic, or they can always go someplace else, because they have that wealth and that ability to be able to exercise any option they want, because that's what their paycheck allows them to do. I want you to tell the story about this county and about the landscape of the county, who lives there, who owns property there, the difference between the inequality in that community that we see across the country, and about what happened when COVID hit, because we will be sympathetic, at least initially, to both sides a little bit. But then as the story goes on, you begin to realize that money assumes power. This is an interesting story because in the end, while they had the money, they didn't necessarily have the power because they didn't have the vote. And what I love about this story is that in some ways, I read it before the results in Georgia. And it turns out that the results in Georgia wasn't really about money, but it was about people who could exercise the franchise and found their power. And a lot of those people that voted were never going to be rich, but there was a lot of African Americans and young people who suddenly realized that if they wanted to see their voices represented in the United States, they needed to vote. And it wasn't the money that brought them in. It was their understanding and their connection that franchise was also their power. So welcome to the program, Nick Bolin. Begin from the beginning by telling the story of this Colorado county, because it is just an amazing story. Welcome.
Well, thanks, Arnie, for having me on. Gunnison County, Colorado, is sort of south-central part of the state, very high in the Rocky Mountains. The valley, the Gunnison Valley, is about 7,700 feet. And the mountains get much, much higher around there. And it's because of these mountains that the area has become a real tourist destination over the past couple decades. There's a famous ski resort at the north end of the county. In the summer, people come to mountain bike and raft on the rivers, that sort of thing. And it was basically because of ski tourism that COVID came to this pretty remote rural county. Only has about 17,000 permanent residents. Pretty early on, February and March. And the county, as you described in your introduction, the county officials were really struggling to know what to do with this. There's a small hospital with 24 beds and no ICU unit. At the end of March, some data from Johns Hopkins, collecting data at that time was hard, but Gunnison made the top 10 list of per capita case rate in the entire country. So it was kind of New York at the top, a couple surrounding New York counties, and then it was a bunch of western ski counties like Gunnison that basically tourism brought the virus to early. What the Gunnison County Commission and Public Health Department decided to do in early April was tell all of the non-resident property owners to leave. And there are a lot of them, especially in the town right below the ski resort, which is called Crested Butte. A lot of people, very wealthy people, have second, third homes in and around the resort.
And let's remind people, they're not just homes, they're mansions.
They are mansions. And you know, it does attract some of, you know, the richest people in the country.
In the country, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, you know, I note in the article, the Koch brother that you don't hear very much about, the third one, has a big mansion there. T. Boone Pickens, the oil billionaire, he's been known to kind of come and go. It really is a destination for...
Well, and let me just share something with you, because I saw that there were a lot of rich Texans that has come to this area. And the rich Texans, hedge fund managers, whatever, have relationships. And when they were being sent this information that they were being asked to leave, they were BS, they were furious. And they didn't want to leave. And they were like, who are you to do this? And because they have relationships and their home is in Texas, you need to know that my biggest radio audience is in Houston, Texas. And one of the people that we follow in Texas is the indicted attorney general, Ken Paxton. And what blew my mind as I'm reading your article is that the indicted attorney general, Ken Paxton, one of the biggest cronies for Donald Trump, one of the people that basically was encouraging people to show up on January 6th and go wild, was actually in your article. So can you share with my audience how the indicted attorney general of Texas ends up in an article about this town, this county in Colorado, because again, it shows the power of the wealthy and their influence. And then they bring their sort of connections to fore in order to fight this small town and this small county where people are trying to keep everyone safe with not a lot of information to work with.
Sure. So it's early April, like I said, and the county is experiencing this really severe COVID outbreak. And the county asks, if you're not a resident, permanent resident of the county, you got to get out. As you know, there are a lot of the non-resident property owners are from Texas. And it turns out that a lot of them got in touch with the Attorney General of Texas, Ken Paxton. I put in a records request around that time. You come back with a handful of emails from Gunnison property owners complaining to Paxton, saying that this is a violation of property rights. We should be able to go to our Gunnison property and shelter there. And some of these property owners were better connected than others. There was an Associated Press investigation around that time that showed that some pretty high dollar Paxton campaign donors that over the years had donated hundreds of thousands of dollars to his political campaigns owned properties in Crested Butte, including a guy who he was known to be close with, who he went to college with, actually. Paxton, in early April, very shortly after the order to leave was released, sent a public letter to Gunnison County saying, you're violating the property rights of Texans. He did not explicitly threaten a lawsuit, but you know, when the Attorney General, that was kind of the subtext. So Paxton, in the midst of all of the other virus pandemonium of April, was sticking up for the second homeowners of Gunnison County.
I'm going to add a little sort of nugget of information. So this was a county, 17,000. The regular people that live there year round are not, for the most part, affluent. They struggle. There's no affordable housing. You mentioned they only have one tiny hospital. There are no ICUs. Obviously, when you even look at the sort of the bios on the county officials, they look like the county. Right? They look like the year-round residents because that's what they are. They live and die in that county. They don't have the opportunity to leave. One of the frustrations that these very wealthy second, third, and fourth homeowners have with their mansions is that when you look at what actually pays the bills in the county, 60% of the county's property tax revenue comes from property owners whose primary residents are elsewhere.
Yes.
So they think we're rich. We pay the bills. We contribute to your nonprofits. The only reason why you're able to survive is because of us. And now you have the chutzpah to send us a notice that tells us that we should leave. That, I think, is important to understand their headset. Hey, we paid for this. What the hell are you doing telling us to go? And then you obviously have the headset of the people that live there year round. They're going, but if you don't go and COVID gets even worse, you can leave, but we have nowhere to go but here and you will be killing us. So they're really making this very, very difficult decision.
Right. As you say, there's pretty extreme wealth inequality in the county. It is the second homeowners aren't wrong that a lot of the economic tax revenue comes from taxes that they pay on property that isn't their first residence. The economy is so tourism dependent that a lot of the jobs and restaurants and all this stuff depends on people coming in for skiing and biking in the summer. The second homeowner's response was basically like, in some cases, it was framed around gratitude, like you're not being properly grateful for our economic contributions. A certain faction, and it's not all of them, but it was a faction of the second homeowners were so upset by the county order to leave that in April and May, they got together on a private Facebook group and they started forming a super PAC in right. an attempt to influence the county commissioner elections of November 2020. And it was basically framed around this issue. You told us to leave. This was wrong. And we're going to try to get you out of office.
So I want to loop back again, because as I started this conversation, I talked about the fact that nobody really understood what to do. Nobody knew how to react. We just interviewed an employment lawyer, okay? And you know what she told me when she sent me the email? I love her. But she said, whatever you do, don't ask me about COVID-related issues because the law is in flux, okay? Listen to her. This is today. Imagine if that's in flux. Our knowledge and understanding of how to respond to COVID at the earliest stages of COVID, especially in a county where they see it rampant, people were just trying to figure out what to do to stop what they didn't quite understand and to keep people safe. My understanding from reading your article, Nick, is that initially they were very extreme. You have to leave, da 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 da. But then within a couple of maybe days or weeks, they modified the request. And they said, if you have sheltered in place, or if you have a negative testing or whatever, you don't have to go. So they actually learned more. And what they first reacted to, they kind of mellowed on in order to, one, recognize the science that they didn't quite understand. And to also say to people, maybe it's better if you stay, if you sheltered in place, because we know that you're not a carrier. And that may be a better thing than having you go on an airplane or send you away. I think what's so sad here, even recognizing that they tried to amend the initial response, that they continued, because of their affluence, because of their arrogance, to move forward with this super PAC to try to impact an election in November.
I quote a couple county officials of various kinds in the story who do say, you know, we didn't handle the COVID response perfectly. The letter that we sent to the homeowners is kind of abrupt. As you say, they amended the health order very quickly. It was a chaotic time. From the perspective of the second homeowners and from conversations I observed them having in this Facebook group, for them, the damage had kind of already been done. They kicked us out. That was a bridge too far. And then I think another important thing to understand about Colorado, not just Colorado, mountain towns is a thing in the West of all kinds, is that there is this dynamic of people who own property there but don't live there full time, and the locals who often end up working in, not all of them, you know, there is a lot of people who work in service industry jobs, right, and that there is a certain amount of tension there, not all the time, it comes up, and that COVID and the second homeowner ban and the response from the second homeowners, definitely these dynamics have been present, really intensified.
You went to St. Olaf, I went to St. Olaf. There was tension between the town and the gown, okay? Yep. We see that. We see that in these areas where, you know, you see in tourist areas, you know, they love the tourists. At the same time, there's an arrogance of tourism sometimes where they basically assume that there isn't the same kind of respect. Like, you're walking on my property. Oh, but I'm just, you know, taking pictures of the mountains, but you're walking on my property. The idea somehow is you're there to serve them, the second homeowner or the tourist, as opposed to the fact that you have rights too, because you live there. You know, and that there is this idea of, can we find some mutual respect? And then, so you know that there's a history of this problem before COVID hit. COVID hits, everyone is terrified, making these sort of irrational or rational decisions based on how you look at it. And the other problem is, and this is also true of Colorado and very true of Texas, and in my state, you know, very libertarian, is that the idea is, you can't tell me what to do with my property. I lived in a town, Nick, that never had zoning or property issues. Never, okay? Had no zoning. Do you know why?
Why?
They didn't need zoning because the person who owned 70% of the town was one man. He was the zoning. Therefore, he didn't want to have any kind of zoning rules because he didn't need it, because he controlled the town, because he was the zoning czar. This is common. What happened, I think, with COVID is that it sort of pulled the scabs off of everything and intensified everybody's reaction.
That's certainly what happened in Gunnison County. I do think it's important to say that no one who lives in Gunnison County would deny the importance of tourism, because I mean, that's the main thing. But then it became not just an economic relationship, but, well, a political one, because the issue of who Gunnison County voters want to vote for, the commissioners who ended up implementing the second homeowner ban were reelected this fall.
The rich people, while they had money, they couldn't run. Because they weren't, this is not their residence.
And they can't vote because they're not permanent residents.
That's right. And they couldn't vote. They've got wealth. They pay 60% of the property taxes. So they think that they should control. But the problem is the people that ultimately control are the people that can exercise the franchise. So take us in the next 10 minutes through what happens to the election. Because I want them to understand that even though they had rehabilitated some of the rules that offended these people, they still were looking for people that would be more willing to go along with the 60% contributors to the property taxes than the people that actually live there.
Basically, it's summer, early summer, the super PAC was formed and started taking contributions. There were two candidates who emerged to challenge the two incumbents on the county commission, and the super PAC backed them. And both of the candidates who emerged were critical, I would say, of the ban on second homeowners back in April. And that this really, you know, there are tons of other issues. There's land use, there's ranching, there's affordable housing. But the super PAC's presence in the campaign really did come to dominate the race. The two candidates who were backed by the super PAC, you know, they were constantly answering questions in public forums about their relationship to it, letters to the editor in the local papers. There was a lot of, I would say that it probably didn't help them. One of the ways that I end the story is I talked to one of the candidates who admits that her association with the super PAC, and kind of in her defense, it's a super PAC. You can't control whether they support you or not. She didn't think that it helped her at all. And she thought that it probably hurt.
Right. So I know the super PAC was able to cut checks, and they're not able to cut checks directly to the candidate, but they can sort of create the atmospherics and they can do everything else that sort of suggests why you should
campaign vote. Advertising, right. You know, signs, ads in the newspaper. That's all campaigning that super PACs are allowed.
My understanding is from your piece, was it the super PAC or some group that did sort of create these public opportunities where the United States Senator who's running, who's a Republican, a big Trump supporter, shows up, they show up. The super PAC is sort of maybe part of what underwrites the event. I mean, again, yes, you can't control what a super PAC does, but you don't have to attend every event that a super PAC is encouraging you to go to. And by showing up, it almost looks like you're genuflecting to their cash. Behavior is how you're judged.
The event you refer to, it was a private event at the mansion on the ski mountain of the guy who started the super PAC. And Cory Gardner, the senator from Colorado at the time who lost re-election this fall, he was there. And then along with the two candidates who the super PAC was supporting. And this, like I said, I mean, just the next week in the local paper, there were people writing in who said, I've been a Republican voter at times in my life, but I got to wonder who these candidates are going to represent if that's how they're spending their time. And that, you know, that's one of the things that the candidate in question I mentioned before ended up expressing regret about, because regardless of how she thought about her relationship to the super PAC, it's pretty clear that a lot of residents of Gunnison County saw this as a conflict of interest, perhaps, or that there's an entanglement with this group that would not be her constituents.
The election was November. Do you still live in this area?
Yes.
So tell me what's happened since the election. How do you put the pieces back together? How do you sort of recognize that we're all panicked about COVID and now it's getting worse? And obviously it's slamming our public health system, which we don't even have. It's slamming our hospitals, which are now breaking under the pressure. These people didn't hate second homeowners. They were trying to protect people who didn't have the same opportunities that wealthy people who can come in and leave have. And therefore, what they were doing was trying to protect the person that works at the bar, the person that cleans the hotel. All the people that you know can't probably afford to live there. They probably don't even have health care. They're very, very low wage workers. I mean, it's kind of like, how do you make a decision without offending someone? But isn't it better to offend the wealthy who can always find the supports they need and protect the vulnerable, which really is what's represented in that county? And they chose to protect the vulnerable.
That is the calculation, I guess. So the incumbent county commissioners did choose to err on the side of, offending the non-residents. And at least politically, it worked out. They were reelected quite handily. Since the election, the COVID rate is certainly high, worryingly high. There's a lot of questions about how to handle things like the ski tourism, right? Where it's back to winter again. You know, businesses close if they don't get ski tourism. So that, you know, the ski mountain's open, but indoor dining, all the things that kind of ripple out from ski tourism is prone to causing infections. And so I don't think the difficulty of governing the public health balance in this county has gotten any easier. The income disparities aren't going anywhere. And affordable housing was probably the number one issue in the campaign. All the candidates, the incumbents and those backed by the super PAC said that that is the number one priority for Gunnison County. And I know that they're desperately trying to figure out how to build more, how to allow-
All are, we all are. Housing,
live,
housing-
To both live here and work here.
And let me share, so you're Colorado, I'm New Hampshire. You know what we're finding? People are upbidding properties because everybody is fleeing the cities. They're fleeing whatever. They want to sort of find a place. And what we're finding is we're becoming the refuge for a lot of individuals who are either looking for second or third homes or completely relocate. That's a good thing, but it's a bad thing for people that need to live here, that need to find a rental unit here, that thought they could buy a house for $190,000 and now find out that same house is now just sold for $290,000, $100,000 more than we ever thought possible. So this is going to be a challenge going forward. What I'm going to ask you to do in the last minute is read your last paragraph of your
last piece. Paragraph.
Yeah, the last paragraph, paragraph and a half. It's just very powerful. Last paragraph.
All right. So I guess the context here is that I'm talking to a local bookstore owner who I interviewed for the piece and who was critical of the super PAC and ended up being kind of targeted by them. So we're sitting behind his bookstore and I write, sitting behind his bookstore, he told me that community is about social bonds between people where mutual dependence upon and responsibility for one's neighbors link individuals in an interlocking series of relationships. One acquires a place in a community as one shares in those relationships of mutual care and accountability. In gambling terms, he said, all his bets are on Crestview. Quote, I don't have anywhere else to go, he said. I don't have another home. I don't really have another place off the top of my head that I could even think of. And it's community in this sense, a shared life across time and a shared fate in a specific place that eludes the second homeowners. By virtue of their wealth, their permanent residency stamped elsewhere, they remain removed from the fate and well-being of the people who live full-time in the Gunnison Valley. They can escape in a way that Ram Gulam cannot. There's an entanglement with the fate of his neighbors, he said, that fundamentally is not shared by someone with the opportunity to pick up and leave when troubles come. What happens to Crested Butte, good or bad, happens to him.
On that note, Nick Boland, fabulous piece. When COVID hit, a Colorado county kicked out second homeowners. They hit back. Thank you for writing. Keep doing it. And I'm glad you went to St. Olaf too.
Likewise. Thanks for having me on.
All right. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, the producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will show you tomorrow. Ciao.